Japan celebrate a World Baseball Classic championship.
Yeah, it's classic, all right. Good thing I already call it a classic, because that was a classic. Shohei Ohtani, greatest player on planet Earth right now, taking it to the second best player on planet Earth in the bottom or top of the ninth inning yesterday in a 3-2 victory for Team Japan in the World Baseball Classic Final. Let's talk to our pal, Adnan Virk, MLB Network, NHL Network, Cinephile Podcast. Ramadan Mubarak to you, Adnan.
Oh, you're a good man, Ben. I appreciate that, buddy. I want to apologize to everybody out there if I'm hangry for the next 30 days. For those who are unaware, as Ben does know, I'm Muslim, so I have to fast. Sunrise to sunset, nothing. So I get so cranky, man. God, 4 and 5 o'clock, I'm just barking at my kids. And then we just go to town at sunset, which you're really not supposed to do. You're supposed to have like one meal, but I just end up gorging because I just can't help myself and I'm a pig. But thank you, buddy, for the kind words. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Hopefully we get through the next 30 days, excuse me, and no worse for wear.
Yeah, I imagine day one is the toughest. Middle of this thing, yeah you'll be well attuned to what your body is going through. But yeah, Ramadan Mubarak to you. So we talked about the incredible scene in Miami yesterday off the top of the show, and Blake and I were going through like some of the our favorite baseball memories over the last like 20 years, and then thinking about that moment belonging alongside them, and we agreed that it does. Do you agree?
Honestly, it's so fresh in the moment. As you said, Ben, it is a classic right now. It's an instant classic. I don't know how it sizes up with that stuff. Our dear friend Mad Dog Russo had to be the one guy crapping on the World Baseball Classic today, right? Every single baseball fan is still, you know, shaking after what happened last time. I mean, if I had said to you guys, Aaron Sorkin couldn't write a script better than this. USA, Japan, one-run game, Ohtani, Trout. That's as good as it gets. And he's there going, well, it's just an exhibition. It's not like the games mean anything. They don't mean anything. Go ask any of these players who play for Japan or the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico or Venezuela or Cuba how much these games mean. Just because to perhaps some Americans it's a meaningless exhibition does not mean to the players it was not meaningful. For God's sakes, Mike Trout is as American as apple pie, and he's saying it's the highlight of my career. Wearing USA on my chest was awesome. It's as close as I'll get to the Olympics, so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's hard for me right now if I say, okay, best baseball games of the last 10 years, you know, can I qualify WBC along with regular season baseball or playoff baseball? But sure, at the end of the day, it is baseball, and I'm not going to forget Trey Turner's exploits anytime soon. Like that grand slam he hit, I was like, man, it jolted me off the couch. So there's been plenty of great moments like that. And the Arozarena catch and the pose afterwards might be my favorite moment of the tourney. It's so funny.
Adnan, you mentioned Aaron Sorkin couldn't write a better one. That's not surprising. I imagine Shohei's pregame speech would have been very overwritten and overly dramatic if it were Aaron Sorkin.
People walking while talking at the same time.
Right, walk and talk. Well
yes,
done.
Of course. All the female characters being minimized, all that stuff. But the pregame speech, how much does that feed into how you think this will be remembered? Because I would imagine that when we start to see highlight packages looking back at this moment, a lot of that is going to have, whether, you know, whether with subtitles or whatever, Shohei's pregame speech being a part of that, where he said, you know, you can't, I'm paraphrasing, but you can't be in awe of them and respect them too much if you're going to surpass them, and you're here to surpass them. And then he does that in that moment to Mike Trout, the one guy who prior to this tournament maybe had an argument to be the only guy on earth better at baseball than Shohei Ohtani. How much is that going to play in how we remember this? Like, obviously, it's Japan, U.S., there's a ton of great stuff in this tournament, but it really does seem like it also solidified Shohei as, well, you can't really question he's the best player in the world now.
Without question. And here's my dream, Blake. I hope that this ends up being the turning point in how we look at Shohei Ohtani, because after this year, he's not going to be on the Angels. He's going to go to a team, I'm hoping, on the East Coast, because if we're being honest here, I fell asleep during a couple of World Baseball Classic games, because like Ben, I've got young kids and I'm up early, and I was like, man, They got this piss clock going. 10:47 is too late for Burke. And I can't watch enough Shohei Ohtani games with 10:07 first pitch. So I'm hoping what happens is he goes to an East Coast team. I hope it's a juggernaut. I hope he's a stud. I hope he wins World Series. And we're going to look back and go, man, remember that World Baseball Classic? That was the first time we got to see Shohei Ohtani in a pressurized situation in an environment like that with high stakes, and he flourished. So it shouldn't be surprising now in 2035 that he's won three World Series now playing for insert team. So I think that's probably the biggest takeaway of the tournament. Like I said, the Trey Turner stuff was awesome just because, I mean, I can't wait to see what he does with the Phillies and the way he was able to hit just home runs of such magnitude. But I do think Ohtani, as you said, in many ways, it's a coming out party. I can't imagine those that don't know Shohei Ohtani prior to this tournament, but maybe there were some, right? Maybe there's some. Well, one thing we know about Americans is they really get patriotic. They may not follow an event, but if there's a USA on the jersey, they will watch it. So I definitely know people who are not big baseball fans who watch the World Baseball Classic because it was a sleepy Tuesday night. Wasn't much going on in terms of NBA or hockey. Hey, I'm going to cheer for my country. Oh, this guy Ohtani's pretty good. Like, they're going to remember these moments and say, yeah, this guy's pretty filthy. Like, what he was able to do collectively, I looked at the numbers. I think Trout had like a 960 OPS. Ohtani's was like 1345 through nine innings, only allowed two runs, two wins, and a save. Like, it's just ridiculous what his numbers are. Like, I don't care if someone says it's a meaningless exhibition. No, it meant a lot to these guys, and Ohtani proved he's great under pressure, as did Trout, who, as we know, we've only ever seen before 2014 ALDS, three meaningless games now against the Royals. So, yeah, I mean, I hope it, for Ohtani, we'll look back and go, this was the moment we all accepted. This guy is incredible, and this was the first of many notable achievements he had in his career. And here's what also really stands out to me about Ohtani. It's the first time we really saw emotion from him like this. Like, I watched it a couple of times, that double he hit against Mexico, and the way rounding first, the way he, you know, threw the helmet off, and the way he's screaming that primal joy. I mean, I've never seen Ohtani like that. And to your point, Blake, that speech he gave to his teammates will go down like Jason Hayward, right? Rallying the troops in the 2016 Game 7 Cubs-Indians at the time. Whatever he said to the team sparked them. Yeah, that'll be Ohtani's Jason Hayward moment. But let's hope he has a lot of better moments in the field than Jason Hayward.
Sorry if you don't know the answer to this, but, like, where is Ichiro? I know they had his jersey on, like, a hanger, and they were, like, honoring him, and they put, like, a medal around the hanger. I'm searching for information on Ichiro. Why wouldn't he be there if he's okay? It's just, like, the Ichiro thing is a little confusing to me.
Yeah, I have no idea, Ben. That is a great question. You know, you saw so many players, whether or not they're part of this team or just have the same ancestry, that were there and seeing like Japan paying homage to him, as you said, but him not being there, I honestly have no idea. I've got to think he has some other conflict, but I can't imagine what would be bigger than the World Baseball Classic in Japan. Somebody told me this stat. One of our researchers said there's like problems with the plumbing in Japan because everyone was going to the bathroom at the same time. And I said, I could totally believe it. And like, I heard some number, fellas, it got an 80 share. To put that into perspective, Japan's a country of 55 million. That means like 45 million people were watching. Again, as Canadians, 35 million. Could you imagine 28 million people watching the Stanley Cup final? Like, that's where those numbers are. It's 300 million Americans watching the Super Bowl. It is just insane.
No, it makes no sense. So back to the rivalry, or the one that exists at least on their baseball reference page between Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani. But that's it, right? That they're teammates and they're good buds and you know, Trout said, oh, he got round one and we'll see him in round two, whatever that means. Maybe it means 3 years maybe it means after the trade deadline this year when he's playing for another team after the Angels have traded him away. But that's it. That I wouldn't ask you if you think Mike Trout cares about being known as the best baseball player on planet Earth right now, because I know the answer, and it's that he doesn't really. Like, it seems that way. Is that kind of, does that diminish it a little bit? Like, do we want him to care more? Do we want him to be like, man, that sucks. Like, I want to be the best baseball player on planet Earth. And like, you go on another team and let's face it off again in the World Series. And then I'll show you.
Well, just as I mentioned, Ben, with Ohtani, how refreshing it was to see him so invigorated and to see so much unbridled emotion out of him. It would have been nice if after Mike Trout struck out, he just slammed the bat in disgust. Yeah. Right? Just once you'd say, wow, so this guy doesn't just like to hunt and fish. He's not just collecting his $426.5 million on a team that's perennially a doormat. Like, he really, really does care. And even if emotion and showing visible emotion is not something that comes easily to him. He purposely keeps it inside. Like in this moment, he was like, argh, and just threw the bat through. Like, wow, Kane really does mean something to him. Because to your point, otherwise you kind of go, does it really matter that much to him? Like, again, is he the guy going, well, it's just the World Baseball Classic. We had a good time. But, like, is he going to have a sleepless night? That's always my thing. When you hear people say that sleepless night, like Mark DeRosa, my buddy, obviously did a great job as a manager. We hope to have him back, unless he gets a managing job in the next week and a half. We hope to have him back at MLB Central next week in MLB Network. You know, he said after that one game against Valenzuela, he goes, you know, I stayed up till 4 a.m. reading what a terrible manager I am. You know, he left Daniel Barn in too long. But, like, when managers say it eats you up and it keeps me up all night, they genuinely mean that. I've heard Terry Francona say that, or Aaron Boone, or Alex Cora, or David Ross. Like, to Mike Trout, I don't know if it keeps him up at night. Actually, I know the answer. I don't think it keeps him up at night. You know what I mean? They're super competitive guys. And it's not necessarily a knock against Trout, but it goes back to your point, Ben. Like, what really matters to this guy? Like, ultimately, how much do you want to be a winner? How much do you want to be a champion? And in that moment, maybe it was just repressed, but I think he was like, eh. Round one to Ohtani. It was fun. Sends out a tweet. I think Mike Trout just went along with his day. I'm not sure everybody else in that USA dugout felt the same.
Huh. It's an interesting take on it, because I understand that, and I understand that that's been not a criticism of Trout, but just like something everyone would like to see out of him a little bit more. In that moment, I kind of just assumed it was like out of respect for Shohei Ohtani. You know, you took the L, and the guy who got the better of you, it's his moment. Don't slam the bat and show him up. That's kind of what I assumed, but it's interesting to hear that. And I do wonder, you know, I don't think I know that it doesn't have any real impact on Mike Trout's stat line or his production or anything like that. I do wonder though, if this gives him a little push. And Ben, you laid out the scenario where, you know, they separate and they want to meet again. We've seen that these two guys on the same team can't get to the playoffs together. I don't know that you're getting what you want if they separate and one goes in one place. I think the player who leaves is probably going to be in the playoffs a lot, and the other one is not. But Adnan, you mentioned, you know, getting one of these guys to the East Coast and seeing what that rivalry is like, or just seeing Shohei Ohtani on the East Coast a little bit more. What do you make of, you know, the WBC's potential to just add a little bit more of one-on-one rivalry to the sport in general? Because even with heavy divisional play, we don't get a lot of that 1v1 rivalry in the sport, where obviously team level, yeah, you want to beat your division opponents. Everyone wants to, you know, knock off the Red Sox or the Yankees. And there's been Batista and Odor, Batista and Darren O'Day, or Batista and just about everyone else. But it is a little hard to create those kind of lasting one-on-one rivalries that aren't about the laundry. How much do you think a WBC, you know, and I know it's only every 4 years, but we're getting another one in 3 years. Could that contribute to making that a bigger part of, you know, how we enjoy baseball?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an aspect to it. I mean, I'll tell you, in the past, I think I casually watched the World Baseball Classic, and especially because Canada quickly gets knocked out, I didn't have a ton of attention. This year, I watched it. Like, I was avidly watching it as much as possible. I was locked into Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic. I wanted to see the semifinal games and, of course, the final and see what could happen. So I think it does help in terms of the awareness of the game. And that's the biggest, you know, answer, I suppose, to anybody who's critical of the tournament and says, how do you think the Mets feel losing Edwin Diaz? How do you think the Astros feel losing Jose Altuve? Yeah. Again, injuries can happen at any point. If you ask Rob Manfred, I would guess he'd say, you know, the damage that does on an individual level is outweighed by the growth the game will experience for moments like this. Like, you are going to get baseball fans now and say, man, I can't wait for the next World Baseball Classic. I'm into the baseball now. I'm going to watch more Major League Baseball. And I think it's not just seeing the players that we know in their other countries, but also the guys you don't know. Like, all of a sudden, those stars born moments from players who say, wow, I never heard of this guy before because obviously he hasn't been playing the Major League Baseball. Now I'm going to pay attention to him. But I do think Commissioner Manfred made a good point about hoping to get some more named pitchers in there.
Yeah.
Like, a part of me says, if I'm a USA Baseball fan, I'm like, yeah, we lost, but we had Merrill Kelly pitching. Like, with all respect, if we had Justin Verlander or Max Scherzer or Garrett Cole, like, we would have handled these guys. So it doesn't necessarily mean Japan's the best team in the world, but take nothing away from them. And as you said, the likes of Darren O'Day can take it. I mean, USA's relievers were great. There's no doubt about that. It's just their starters were not particularly strong. But I think it does certainly help grow the game, and I think there'll be even more attention and awareness to it. And again, it's unusual because in America, you're going to look at the U.S. numbers and go, ratings weren't great. People care more about March Madness, NFL free agency. But you've got to look beyond the biggest country in the world and say, this clearly was a success. when you look at the way those other countries really rallied around the game.
Poor Merrill Kelly, like, has a you know, revives his professional career, goes overseas, comes back, starts a winner-take-all championship game, but everybody with the same take. It's like, ah, Merrill Kelly starting this game? Wish him all the best, though, honestly.
It should have been better, though, because he played in Japan. Like, he's kind of a avatar for how the globalization of the game can help even American players, even domestic players. Like, he had to go to Japan to find himself, and then he comes back, and, you know, there's a scenario down the line where maybe he's pitching for Japan instead of the United States, given how loose the requirements are. I don't know. I feel for him, because to me, he's like, like Lars Nootbaar, should be one of the kind of faces of why the World Baseball Classic is so cool and how global the game actually is.
Yeah. It's part of it.
Yeah, you could talk yourself into it and say, listen, that's a nice redemptive story, and there's angles to it. But ultimately, people want to see the stars.
Yep.
And I do have to get this Trout-Otani stat in there. The fact that Mike Trout has had 3 swinging strikes and only 24 of his 6,174 wow. career MLB plate appearances.
That's
like,
stupid.
This happens to Trout maybe twice per season, and it happened the one time he's faced Shohei Ohtani. That is mind-boggling to me when I saw that stat. Crazy.
Yeah, let's see him do it in July, though, when he's all warmed up and ready to go. But no, that was pretty Shohei looked pretty warmed up throwing 102. So you talked about your boss, Commissioner Manfred, who's on like a nice little run here, because everybody's, I think, pretty universally loved the new rule changes. WBC getting tons of love and finishes in storybook fashion. He releases it, or he doesn't release it. It is reported that the memo he sent to all the teams in regards to the slight tweaks around the rule changes headed into the regular season means that there's going to be a microscope on the Bat Boys and Bat Girls, that they could be under the gun, that the teams will be required to perhaps replace them if they're not fast enough. Is that fair game?
Yeah, I think we're getting the Bat Boys and the Bat Girls in there. You know, everyone's on blast. But I think what Rob's doing, which is smart, is that we institute these new rules. We know it's not going to be perfect. We can amend where necessary. But as far as the fabric of the rules, they have not been changed, right? Like, I would have been enormous if he had said, you know what? Instead of 20 seconds between pitches, we're going 25. You know, like, instead of 15 on base, we're going to 18. But it's like, no. Those rules are holding firm. The bases are still going to look like pizza boxes. You're still going to have no shift, even though I know teams will try to cheat and perhaps put an outfielder over, which would be something of a shift, although then you'd have all left field open. But yeah, even the Bat Boys and Bat Girls are going to be involved. Like, I think what Rob's saying is that we really want this to work, okay? And the only way things can work is if every I is dotted, every T is crossed. So yeah, even the Bat Boys and Bat Girls, let's do this as expediently as possible. I was in studio today for the Jays and the Orioles doing post-game afterwards. Mm. As you guys know, 2-hour and 10-minute game.
Oh.
And I'm like, I don't know if Jose Barrios is going to throw a lot of 5-inning, no-run games, but I'm like, this is incredible, this pace of play. Like, I cannot wait to see a 2-hour, 10-minute Major League game. And I will gladly support any Bat Boys or Bat Girls doing their job as swiftly as possible.
All right. I know this is a total non sequitur, but I wanted to get to it yesterday. And I know I can't surprise you with any topic that I bring up, but slam ball is coming back in July, apparently. Is this I assume you know what slam ball is. It's the basketball game played on trampolines. Is this a thing that people actually like, or is it that they like the idea of slam ball?
I think it's got to be the latter. Like, I heard about this and I was like, no, a form of basketball played with 4 trampolines in front of each net and boards around the court edge. And when I looked it up, I'm like, Blake Griffin is like one of the supporters of this. I'm like, what? Like, I'm an old man. I just like to play tennis. I don't like this pickleball nonsense. I go, wait, no, it's so good. It combines ping pong and tennis. I'm like, no, I like to play tennis. Like, I'm not very good. I just want to run around, get a sweat on, rather than go to the gym. I don't want to do this pickleball stuff. And when I hear slam ball, again, like, no, we're going to combine basketball and football with trampolines, and there's big investors. And I go, no. Like, the fact there's a 6-week season in Las Vegas happening, I'm not watching it, okay? I'm not watching XFL. I'm not watching USFL. I see all this nonsense trying to cut through, and I go, I got it. July is kind of a slow time. Why not? Let's give it a chance. But I will not be. I'm not giving a slam dunk to slam ball, making a return more than 20 years after its inception.
Yeah. Apparently nobody's watching the XFL. So, yeah, you join the group. I have a better chance of watching slam ball than, like, professional pickleball, though, I will say.
I'll tell you what. My annual summer league trip for NBA Summer League to Vegas – could potentially include Slam Ball, the WNBA All-Star Game, and NBA Summer League all at once. Yeah. It could be...
What a trip that could be.
Like, Summer League basketball is pretty low on the rankings of quality of basketball, but to get to go see worse basketball at Slam Ball would be truly special. And the guys who like get cut from Summer League, they could just go try out for Slam Ball and be the best players in the league.
It's quite a thing. Adnan, you're quite a guy. Hey, have an easy fast, man. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much, Ben. That's so kind of you to mention. I was going to say to all my fellow Muslims out there, let's hopefully have some easy fasts. We won't be too hangry. And I wish you guys the best as always. Talk to you soon.
See him, buddy. Adnan Virk, MLB Network, NHL Network, and the Cinephile Podcast. Yeah, I know it was like out of nowhere, but like another day passes, and you know, Slam Ball, the announcement that it's returning in summer becomes less and less relevant. And I have Slam Ball takes. Okay, I saw it the first time it came around, and I was intrigued. And sure, did I tune in for like 30 seconds to 2 minutes of Slam Ball the first time around? Yeah. Well, did I have enough at that point? I did. Why do people want it back? I'm not sure. People think that there's an appetite to watch pickleball, professional pickleball on tickleball would be fun too. But and there are millionaires, billionaires who think people want to watch Slam Ball, which I feel like they don't.
I think Slam Ball was cool when it was just on Spike TV like all times of day. That's so it. If you were just sitting around,
wanted to see somebody's ankle shatter.
Yeah, and like leaving it on as a 16-year-old boy, like leaving it on Spike TV as the channel that's just on in the background was a pretty safe bet. I don't know. And I honestly, in terms, I don't want to dismiss things like Slam Ball in the XFL, etc. in general, because I think, like we just talked about with the World Baseball Classic, something that seems maybe like it doesn't fit at the outset because it doesn't exist yet can really succeed. I just don't think running back Slam Ball and XFL, which have already failed, is going to be it. Slam Ball has at least the benefit of it's a very like Instagrammable sport. The highlights will be really cool, but that's a gift and a curse because I don't know how much the cool Slam Ball plays are driving people to watch the actual game versus I'm going to get what I need out of this on Instagram and Twitter.
It's that one.
The XFL just has none of that going for it other than the it has the letter X and it makes for a cooler logo.
Yeah, bring back the thing where they run into each other and separate each other's shoulders like in a face-off to start the game.
So when the XFL existed before, it has like this was before a lot of the cord cutting and sports viewership numbers were just declining in general. It had one of the most ridiculous ratings declines like rapidly and significantly that we've ever seen in like anything. Like it started out getting like 3.5-4 million viewers. And then by the end, by the time it got canceled the first time, it was down into like the 400,000s. Now it's back and it's like, I think it popped 1 million for the first week or two. We're talking about like 200,000 now watching it. That's rough. Not very much.
No, it's
like
it's,
that is in the entire United States, half as many people, not even half as many people are watching XFL as we're watching the WBC final in Canada last night, which is a significantly smaller country.
Yeah, quite significant. By a factor of 10. Speaking of running things back that just failed, Jose Barrios started in today's spring game.
Wow, mean. Mean.
Hey, man, I didn't have the ERA over 5 on the first of a 7-year extension. But no, he was good, okay? Coming off of the also failure, World Baseball Classic start for Team Puerto Rico, and many hands were wrung headed into this start today, and he did what you would have hoped him to do against an Orioles team that didn't have everybody in there, but got up to 77 pitches, gave up 1 run over 5, struck out 7. I mean, is anything that's happened?
He struck out 5.
Where did I get 7 from?
I don't know. Anyways, he did strike out the side at one point, which is nice.
Yeah, he gave up 1 run over 5 and struck out 5, but threw 77 pitches. Has anything that's happened over this spring, whether it's the one horrible start that he couldn't get out of the first inning against four-team Puerto Rico, or what we've seen outside of that, which has been pretty good results in spring training games, and, you know, so is Yusei Kikuchi, although the walks are starting to creep up in each and every subsequent Yusei Kikuchi spring start. Has anything that's happened here in the last month or so impacted what you think we're about to watch here for 30 Jose Barrios starts?
Not significantly. I think he's looked you know, one start aside, and we can't really bring the Puerto Rico starts into it. I don't think. I just don't. It's such a different environment. And even if you did, like, the things he struggled with are things you'd expect him to struggle with anyway. The three walks over 10 innings is nice. I'm not thinking the 270 ERA is going to kick around. But look, a lot of the more advanced metrics and things we've talked about that are new to pitcher projection stuff, a lot of those things are still fairly confident that given the track record there and given that Jose Berrios' fastball was never an overpowering weapon, that he can get a lot of this back with the secondary stuff. We'll see. I think your margin for error when you throw 94 as your fastball and it's a pretty straight fastball, your margin for error is a little small.
Especially against lefties. But that was the deal coming in. Like, you could look at his baseball reference page and his splits against lefties when he was having great seasons for the Minnesota Twins. This is always a guy that had trouble getting left-handed hitters out.
And so I wonder if, you know, you kind of framed Hyunjin Ryu like this the other day. With Jose Berrios now, are you... I mean, I don't even think it's a question. Like, if the playoffs were to start today, like... Okay, he's your fourth guy in a playoff rotation. Well, like, it's like
Kevin Barker today was talking about him being the most expensive fourth starter in baseball, which I think is pretty accurate, right? Like,
and if he's not, then Chris Bassett is, because one of them is your fourth starter nominally,
which is
right?
Pretty good, right? Like, that's yeah, you're talking about a guy that was the opening day starter, and not just because he signed the extension last year. Like, his entire career track record led you to believe that this was a guy that was capable of being the ace of a staff, and it turned out, like, right out of the gates that he wasn't that. But can he be somebody who, again, like, in some sort of pressure relief, as much as you can be in as a major league starter carrying around that contract, like, as a four starter, can he be a guy that brings the ERA to, like, the low fours or upper threes? I of course. Like, yeah. Again, look at the length of his career. And look at even some of the starts throughout a very up-and-down season. And I know everyone will point to the team's win-loss record that he had. The Blue Jays had the most wins when he was on the mound than anybody else, which is just a weirdo thing. But he did have some great moments and great starts throughout the season last year. Can he string more of those together? Or, I mean, the better question yet is, can he just have less absolutely horrific starts? Yeah, of course.
And that's where I think the bar needs to be in. Yes, he's got a lot of years and a lot of money left. Well, guess what? Eating innings at even a league average ERA is expensive.
Yep.
You have not done, as this team,
But that's what they thought they were buying when they gave him that contract. Not a guy like, hey, upside, maybe he's like a Cy Young contender. But no, this is a guy that's going to take the ball 30 times and give you a league average or slightly better ERA.
Yeah, at the time they acquired him, he had a 3.48 ERA, and that was the best of his career. This wasn't he's a frontline, going to strike out 10, get a 2 ERA and be in the Cy Young conversation. It was, this guy is the most reliable outing-to-outing pitcher in all of baseball, which is, it's hilarious than the way last season went. But I think if you readjust your bar and you know, keep in mind that last season a league average ERA was right around 4, I think we're going to see that go up a little bit this year. But let's say his ERA comes in at 4.25 and he's able to give you 180, 190 innings. That is, as weird as it can sound sometimes because it's such a large number, that's $20 million of value from a starter. 180, 190 innings at league average ERA, which is not league average starter ERA. It's harder to do that as a starter over a big innings load. Like, that's a pretty valuable piece. Like, even last year, he was worth more than a win above replacement just because, like, eating innings is a really thing. Valuable thing over the course of 162. Now, for a team that has championship aspirations, a guy who helps you get there but maybe doesn't move the needle a ton in the playoffs, that's a bit of an awkward spot for a guy like Berrios to be in, but you do still have to get there.
Yep. No, you have to. Yeah. And then you cross that bridge when you get there. And would I like maybe Ricky Tiedemann starting in game 4 of a postseason series? Yeah, maybe.
I think, like, because of the approach that Berrios has and because of what makes Berrios Berrios and what makes up the stuff, I still think, like,
if you're playing a right-handed heavy team also,
or you go, you do kind of the Stripling piggyback, right? Yeah. Which is like, Berrios is going to go. You see how it looks once through the order. Then maybe you turn it to Tiedemann. And I know $20 million for a guy who's only going once through the order in the playoffs, but you like, the money has been paid or the contract has been signed. Maybe the money hasn't actually been paid yet, but you have to look at, you know, where things stand when the playoffs start. And I think Berrios would be in your rotation mix unless Kikuchi is just unbelievable or Tiedemann's ready. And even then, of all those guys, Barrios is the one who makes the least sense moving to the bullpen.
Yep.
Because of his stuff and because of the fact that his primary asset is eating innings for you. So, yeah, even then you're talking about, well, maybe he, you know, starts a game and then you go, he's like the, he's the lead on Johnny Hull's staff day or whatever.
So as Adnan pointed out, today was one of those glorious spring training games where it was done in just over 2 hours' time. It's also a game where, like, we're getting to the point in spring training where the starters start playing longer, almost nine innings. I think we got seven innings out of starters. And you look at that lineup, that's pretty representative, save for maybe Kevin Biggio at second base, but maybe not. Like, this is, I did want to ask you, like, what your thought process is when you look at a guy in Whit Merrifield who was real good as a Blue Jay last year, like in the overall, and really started to come on strong at the end of the season. A guy that, though, over the last 2 years with the Kansas City Royals, looks like he's in decline. Like, what? One, what do you expect his deployment to be? And two, what are reasonable expectations? Like, could this guy possibly get back to being one of the league leaders in hits in the American League?
I don't know that the playing time will be there, just because I do think even if he's good, you're looking at his role being part-time second baseman and fourth and chief fourth outfielder against lefties. If Biggio is good and they want to keep him involved, it might be Biggio who's the fourth outfielder against righties, who gives Springer the odd day off or whatever. It's good to have options there, but Merrifield and Biggio, I think, are probably going to split the fourth outfielder duties, and then Merrifield and Espinal are going to split the second base duties. Injuries and things like that will happen. It's hard to imagine, though, Whit Merrifield getting like the 600 plate appearances it would need. Now, he's hitting pretty well in spring. He hit really well down the stretch last year after a really poor start as a Blue Jay.
Yep.
Like, I did
but
not.
But then, like, he resurrected his numbers to the tune of a 769 OPS with the Blue Jays, because he was like unplayably bad early in that tenure.
And yeah, to the point where, like, he went a couple days without playing and it was like, is he going to get left off the playoff roster?
Yep.
And part of why I didn't love the deal initially was like, yeah, he was owed money for this coming year. Now, he's also a guy that you look back on his stolen base track record and he's stolen 40 bases before. If this team's going to get a little more aggressive on the base paths, and he has not looked good running the bases in spring training so far, he's 2 for 5 stealing bases, but he is someone who is more so than high end speed, a read the pitcher and get good jumps kind of base stealer. I wonder if the rule tweaks maybe make him a little bit more valuable on the base paths as well. So role-wise, I think, you know, he'll get the larger share of the second base split with Santiago Espinal, and we'll see weeks and 2-3 week stretches where one of them's playing more than the other, and it'll bounce back. And then, yeah, I think he splits the fourth left fielder duties with Biggio. What does that end up looking like? Like, is it 400 plate appearances, 450 plate appearances? I think that's reasonable for his age and what they're paying him and what they need him for.
See, I could see that being the scenario. I'd give him the whole rope. Like, I'd give him the everyday second base job, sink or swim, for like a month. And you'll find days to give guys days off. Like, I say every day. Like, even he will get, you know, whatever, his 5 days off a month or whatever, but you will find areas to get Santiago Espinal and Kevin Biggio into the lineup. And I would see if you've actually recaptured something with this guy who played in that cavernous ballpark in Kansas City for a team that was going nowhere, that figured it out, or it looked like he was closer to figuring it out at the end of last season, seeing what you got in him. Because if he is, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that this guy was one of the better contact hitters in all of baseball, not with like average exit velocity, but with like expected batting average, which has been in decline the last 3 years. But like, I would see if that is still in him.
Do you not want, though, like, one of the strengths of this team is right now on paper, it's depth, right? Like whatever happens with the 26th roster spot between Otto, we all seem to think it's Otto Lopez. Nathan Lucas is still around. Whatever happens with that, they have 12 position players who you're pretty comfortable seeing time. Do you not want to move those around a little bit?
Man, somebody's going to get nicked up. Like, something is going to happen. Those guys, although Merrifield's been like super durable,
sure,
throughout his career.
And maybe it's not Merrifield. Maybe it's George Springer or Kevin Kiermaier or whatever.
Right.
And that juggles things around. But isn't that not an argument for, until that happens, keeping everyone in the mix a little bit? Like if Santiago Espinal and Kevin Biggio are both, you know, play one start and one relief appearance a week out of the outset, and then suddenly you need one of those guys more on an everyday basis. I lean toward trying to keep everyone in the mix early. Mm-hmm. I think that lets you see who's playing well, first of all. Mm-hmm. I also think it's easier to shift more of the playing time to someone. Like, I think, say Whit Merrifield's a 5-start-a-week guy. It's hard then to scale him back to, like, 2 starts a week if it's not working. Mm. It's easier if everyone's split to just, like, nudge it in the right direction based on performance. But I also just think mostly if you're a depth team, you want to use that depth and rotate guys around it. And we are probably overstating it because Kiermaier and Varsho probably won't both start against lefties.
No. There'll be plenty of opportunities.
Belt, Springer, Kiermaier are all guys who have been banged up over the years.
Yeah.
Things like that.
And yeah, guys are going to rotate through the DH spot.
Yeah, I want to keep early in the season. I want to keep as many guys involved as possible.
I just look at the ceiling of the player, right? Like the ceiling. Santiago Espinal is deserving of a major league roster spot, even on a good team, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's a good player.
So is Biggio.
Biggio, these are winning players, and their versatility is great. And Biggio, you know, he has his flaws. They both do, but they do things that help teams win. Whit Merrifield is an all-star is a bad way to put it because...
Well, Santiago Espinal is as well.
Yeah, so is he. But no, this is a guy that has led the American League in hits, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is a guy that...
And stolen bases.
Yeah, so that might exist within him. Whatever you have to do to get the best out of Whit Merrifield or see if there's any of that left in him for a guy that's approaching 35, like, I'd be exhausting every opportunity to do that.
That's interesting because I think the age thing works more toward me wanting to spread the touches around because, yeah, maybe you rediscover something with Whit Merrifield, but maybe someone like Santiago Espinal, who's a little younger, unlocks something.
You think he can, like, have we seen the ceiling of Santiago Espinal?
Probably. Like, I think the early part of last year is the ceiling with the bat, to be sure. But I also think he's, like, a very, very good defensive second baseman.
He's a very good defensive shortstop.
Yeah, so the... You know, I don't think the path to Espinal being, like, if we could play the season out once with Merrifield playing every day and once with Espinal playing every day, like, I don't think it's that far-fetched that Espinal could be just as valuable. Now, he'll come about it differently. Super curious what it looks like if they let Espinal go on the base pass because he is a pretty quick guy. He just doesn't have a lot of stolen base track record. Mm. But you also got to get on base to do that. And his OBP and average did kind of fall off once pitchers figured out how to pitch him last year. But you also want to give younger guys an opportunity to play through that, right? Like Whit Merrifield got chances to, as pitchers found holes in his thing, to play through it and figure it out and learn from that. I don't know. I'm in favor of spreading those things around early in the year. Like, I think you have your...
Everyone's going to play, though.
Yeah, that's... I think you have your 5 or 6 everyday guys, and then everyone else can...
And I say every day, like, that should be in quotation marks,
5
right?
starts,
like,
a week.
Oh,
or whatever.
Kevin Kiermaier's the everyday center fielder. We've done this already, right? Like, there are only a couple of guys that are going to come close to playing 162. That's Vlad and that's Bo. That's it.
Those guys do not miss time. It's wild.
Yep. No, it's been spectacular. And lastly, Alek Manoah is going to start the spring game on Friday. Kevin Gausman is going to start the spring game on Saturday. The Blue Jays, along with everybody else in Major League Baseball, are going to announce the opening day starters on Friday. I mean, it seems like a pretty clear indication that Manoah's going to start opening day on Thursday. I know it's on 5 days rest, and Gossman's going to be on super extendo rest with that off day on the Friday. But what, you're going to, like, flip their order now? Like, obviously not.
No, I don't think so. I think we've been pretty, and I know Gossman's last start lined up with every fifth day, but Manoah going one day ahead of Gossman is the smoking gun to me.
Yeah.
Like, that's... Barring someone tearing a fingernail or something like that, this is the way they're going to do it. And the only thing left to figure out, I think we're pretty clear Kikuchi will go in the 5 slot. Bassett and Barrios both started today. Bassett started in a spring training or a minor league game. That's it. That you figure out the 3-4 between those two. Everything else is set. It is remarkable how little stakes there have been in for the rotation in this spring training. And, like, nothing's, like, knock on wood, everything's gone kind of to plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even with no Mitch White.
Yeah. Who also pitched in a minor league game. I don't know if it was the same minor league spring training game, but yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how many of those are going on, but yeah, we'll get the report from Arden tomorrow of how he looked and how, you know, what the next steps are and everything.
All right.
Starting the season on the IL so you can fudge the options, obviously.
Yeah, we'll see. Or maybe long man out of the bullpen. All right. Tonight, Raptors playing their closest pursuer in the play-in tournament, except they have no chance really of catching them. The Pacers tonight down at Scotiabank Arena, who employ three Canadians. We'll set you up for that game next as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy. Oh, it's like a playoff game tonight down at Scotiabank Arena as the Raptors trying to fend off the Indiana Pacers, who are only three games back of them for the, well, the Pacers are in the 11 seed in the Eastern Conference, the last team outside of the play-in tournament. Here's the problem. There's only 10 games to go during the regular season, Blake. And, well, and secondarily, the Pacers just lost to Charlotte, so they kind of stink.
I mean, also, they have been openly trying to not do very well.
Mission successful on Monday when they lost to the Hornets. But the Raptors are in now. Like, any concern about them not getting into the play-in at the bare minimum? Like, Raptors go 5-5. Now, the Pacers have the tiebreaker over the Raptors, having won two of both previous regular season meetings against the Raptors, this being the third.
In dramatic fashion.
So they own the tiebreaker. So a tied regular season record, they would get in over the Raptors. But the Raptors go 5-5, and they're favored, I would think, in at least five of the remaining 10 games. Pacers have to go 8-2. Raptors are in.
Yeah, I actually thought you were bringing this up and laying it out that way facetiously. I didn't think, like, to me, the play-in bracket is more or less set. Like, the Pacers don't want to win. The Magic are too far out of the picture. The Wizards wanted to be in it and are just an absolute disaster. They're 2-8 over their last 10. They've lost, I think, three or four in a row. And then, yeah, like, Atlanta, Raptors, and Bulls are jockeying for a position within there. It's fairly unlikely any of them catch the Heat or the Nets, who are, you know, four games up on the Raptors still. Like, this is jockeying for who gets two cracks at it, who's hosting one, who's hosting two from the playing game. I would be pretty surprised if four of Brooklyn, Miami, Atlanta, Toronto, Chicago aren't the play-in teams. Now, all these teams are average enough that they're one injury or one bad stretch away from, yeah, going on a losing streak, but none of Indiana, Washington, or Orlando are, maybe Washington could rip off a streak where they win a few, but I think this is more or less settled. Indiana's also really banged up. Tyrese Haliburton's not playing tonight, which sucks.
Yeah, that does suck.
Jump passes are good now. It's a Pacers thing. I mean, it's a Tyrese Haliburton thing, but my pal Caitlin Cooper, who was formerly at Indy Cornrows and now does her own thing on Patreon, has done she does an excellent job covering the Pacers in general, but has done specifically a great job covering the uniqueness of Tyrese Haliburton. And we talked about it with Shea, how Shea is kind of a complete original offensively and no one else looks like him. Well, that's Tyrese Haliburton on the Pacers offensively, just like the most... Like, every pass he makes is so good and crisp and in the right spot, and every single one of them is one that if you were a high school basketball coach, you would bench your guy for making that pass. It's pretty amusing. So there are shirts now. Jump passes are good now. But unfortunately, we don't get to see Tyrese Haliburton. We just get to see all the Canadians.
Yeah, we do. And we might not get to see Scottie Barnes, Gary Trent Jr., or Precious Achiuwa. They're all questionable.
They're all game-time decisions. Yeah, the 6:30 injury report is out, and all of them are still listed as game-time decisions. So,
but yeah, we will see Ben Mathurin, Andrew Nembhard, O'Shea Brissett are all healthy and will be playing tonight's game. And I think this is Canada basketball night down at Scotiabank Arena as well.
It is. It's kind of like unofficially like Canada basketball time, like Shea and Jamal Murray both being and Lou Dort, of course, all being here last week. It was announced today that Global Jam, the event that happens in July between Sportsnet and Canada basketball, is back again this summer. In July, you can look online for more details about that. We'll have Canada Basketball CEO Michael Bartlett on with us tomorrow to talk about that. Canada Basketball has also announced more tune-up games in the lead-up to the World Cup this summer, which is a really important thing because one of the drawbacks for Canada's process in these big tournaments in years past has been they kind of go in cold, or they've played like a nobody team as their tune-up. No disrespect to Adam Sandler in The Longest Yard, but like playing Appalachian State before you get into the FIBA World Cup and have to play like Australia and Lithuania, not enough of a tune-up. So good to see all of that. And then, yeah, there will be, you know, depending on how the rotation works out tonight, like potentially four Canadians on the court at once.
Yeah, that'll be cool. I am curious to see what kind of a commitment we get from the Canadian NBA players for this summer's FIBA World Cup. Now, Nick Nurse, there's been plenty going on around Team Canada. They announced a new corporate sponsor in Sun Life yesterday, new jerseys as well. But Nick Nurse was asked about like who he expects to show up this summer in a four faraway place to play international basketball for like no money. Here's what he said, quote, "I know what the communication is with players and the positivity we get about people coming. They're committed, but I don't think it does me or my staff any good to try and figure out exactly who will be available until it gets closer and we see who shows up. Whenever we head down those paths of who will be available, I'm the one who says, let's hope there's a lot of really hard decisions to make." What does that indicate to you, Blake?
Well, I think, you know, I saw some people frustrated with it because, you know, not that long ago, May of last year, Canada Basketball outlined this 14-player summer core. And the idea was these are the 14 guys who are in the mix and have committed to each of the next three offseasons, those three offseasons being last year, this year's World Cup, and next year's Olympics, with the idea being if you are on this list of 14, if you are not, if you are not on this list of 14, and all the spots are filled by guys on this list of 14. Sorry, the Andrew Wigginses of the world. If you decide you want to play and the spots are filled by guys who have made the three-year commitment, too bad. Now, the setup, unfortunately, is never going to be that you can hold any of these 14 to actually showing up and playing. You have things like, you know, we talked about Zach Edey, who wasn't on that, who was on that list rather. You know, if he enters the draft and gets picked and a team wants him with them developing, that's what it is. You can't do a lot about it. Dylan Brooks is on that list. He's a free agent this summer. That makes insurance things really complicated. It's also a scenario where maybe he signs with a new team and they want him getting acclimated with them, because the World Cup is like about a month commitment from the start of training camp to when that tournament begins. And that's before factoring in if Canada goes on a big run.
And then, it's not in like our back door.
No, it's in Indonesia. Canada's pool is rather, and they're going to spend time in Germany and Spain in the lead up to that. So that they are playing, you know, elite competition to iron sharpen iron and all. And then you have someone like Jamal Murray, who's also on that list and is about to embark on what they hope is a deep playoff run when he was still managing his recovery from an ACL tear throughout this season. Is he going to be someone who has to, you know, if Denver makes the NBA finals or the conference finals, does he have to adjust his commitment? These are all just the realities of international play when you have an NBA heavy roster, unfortunately. But what I think Nick Nurse is doing is being realistic about that and being realistic about the fact that there is a really deep pool of talent to draw from. Almost none of these guys had any hand in Canada qualifying for the World Cup. They went 11-1 in the qualifiers, and I think only four of those 12 games, NBA players were even available.
Right.
Like, there is a depth to the program, and you don't want to, you know, you don't want to be pulling from the guys who were like the eighth man in these qualifiers off in the Bahamas in the middle of the NBA season. But if you have to look at, you know, a Daishon Pierre as like a key piece of your bench unit, Canada has the depth at the highest levels of European basketball with significant FIBA experience that if this roster is not 12 NBA players, you should still get to a point where as long as Shea's on the roster,
well, that's what
you
I was
feel
gonna
very
say. He
confident
feels
about
like,
it.
He feels like the linchpin here, and it used to be Andrew Wiggins, and last time we saw a really significant game played by this group, it was Andrew Wiggins with the ball in his hands at the end of that game and looked pretty good. But now it's Shea, like, and Shea is going to be in a play-in game at the very, very least in a Western Conference where everybody has everything to play for. That team has continued to win, and they're 500, and yeah, again, 10 games to go, and they're really, there's only one game separating them and the Lakers, who are currently 11th in the Western Conference. Yeah. But yeah, that's the guy. That's the guy that's going to get down ballot MVP consideration this year.
And it's a guy who, you know, in summers past has been probably of the guys who significantly move the needle. I don't say that with any ounce of disrespect to Kelly Olynyk or Corey Joseph or Dwight Powell or Ken Burch, who have been huge parts of the program. But Shea is at a level where, first of all, short of Steve Nash, we have never seen a Canadian player potentially suiting up for Canada at this level of play ever.
No.
And then also, he is young enough and important enough and popular enough that he could influence other guys coming out to play. Like
100%.
All of those guys I mentioned, it's awesome that they've always been there and they're the backbone of the program. But Shea is the guy who is going to be able to reach across to different teams and be like, I'm going.
Come with me.
You're coming. Let's do something special.
That'd be sweet. All right. Last call brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. Raptors 9-point favorites at home against the Pacers. Jakob Poeltl with the point total of 14.5. Pascal Siakam, 23.5. Fred VanVleet, who's playing some great basketball recently, 20.5. And that was last call. And it was brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. All right, that's it for, I guess, World Baseball Classic conversation. We'll have to figure out something else to talk about tomorrow. See you then. Bye-bye.